of the entrance. "Ah!" Benedict said at last, holding up a sack that clinked like a purse full of gold imperators.
"A worry eased, this is."
He dropped it back in the saddlebag. "What is it?" Simon asked, irritated to be asking another question. Benedict grinned wickedly.
"More Gannock tricks, ones that will be found very useful soon. Come, we should be returning. If the others wake up stiff with drink and alone, they may have fright and be doing something foolish."
Kantaka found them on their short journey back, her mouth and nose daubed with the blood of some luckless animal. She bounded several times around them, then stopped, hackles lifting as she sniffed at the air. She lowered her head and sniffed again, then went loping ahead. Jiriki and Anne had joined Kendra Jaharo. The prince had shed his white robe for a jacket of tan and blue. He held a tall bow, unstrung, and wore a quiver full of brown-fletched arrows. Kantaka circled the Scythi, growling and sniffing, but her tail waved in the air behind her as though she greeted old acquaintances. She lunged forward toward the blithe fair folk, then dodged back, rumbling deep in her throat and shaking her head as though snapping the neck of a rabbit. When Binnabik and Simon joined the circle, she came forward long enough to touch Binnabik's hand with her black nose, then danced away again and resumed her nervous circling.
"Did you find all your possessions in good order?"
Jiriki asked. Binnabik nodded.
"Yes, with certainty. Thanks to you for seeing to our horses."
Jiriki negligently waved his slender hand.
"And what now to do?" he asked.
"I am thinking we should be on our road soon,"
the troll responded, shading his eyes to look at the grey-blue sky.
"Surely not this day,"
Jiriki said.
"Rest this afternoon and eat with us again. We still have much to speak of, and you can leave tomorrow by dawn light."
"You and your uncle show much kindness to us, Prince Jiriki, and honor,"
Binnabik bowed.
"We are not a kind race,
Binbinike Kavenik, not as we once were, but we are a courteous one. Come."
After a splendid lunch of bread, sweet milk, and a wonderfully odd, tangy soup made from nuts and sunflowers, the long afternoon was spent by Scythi and men alike in quiet talk and singing and long naps. Simon slept shallowly and dreamed of Miriamele, standing atop the ocean as though it were a floor of uneven green marble, beckoning him to come to her. In his dream, he saw furious black clouds on the horizon and called out, trying to give warning. The princess did not hear over the gathering wind, only smiled and beckoned. He knew he could not stand on the waves and dove in to swim toward her, but he felt the cold waters pulling him down, tugging him under. When he fought free of the dream at last, it was to awaken in dying afternoon. The pillars of light had dimmed and leaned as though drunken. Some of the Scythi were setting the crystal lamps in their wall niches, but even watching the process gave Simon no better understanding of what lit them. After being put in place, they simply slowly began to glow with gentle, suffusive light. Simon joined his companions at the stone circle around the fire. They were alone. The Scythi, although hospitable and even friendly, nevertheless seemed to prefer their own company, sitting in small knots around the cavern.
"Boy," Hasten said, reaching up to clap his shoulder, "we feared you'd sleep all the day."
"I would sleep too if I ate as much bread as he," Sludik said, cleaning his nails with a sliver of wood.
"All here were agreeing on an early leave-taking tomorrow,"
Binnabik said, and Grimrik and Hasten nodded.
"There is no certainty this mildness of weather will continue long, and it is far we must still go."
"Mild weather?" said Simon, frowning at the stiffness in his legs as he sat down.
"It's snowing like mad."
Binnabik chuckled deep in his throat.
Oh, friend Simon, talk to a snow dweller if you are wanting to know cold weather. This is like our Canuck Spring, when we play naked in the snows of Minterhawk. When we are reaching the mountains, then, I am sorry to say, you will be feeling real coldness.
He doesn't look very sorry at all, Simon thought. So when do we start out?
First light in the east, Sludic said. The sooner, he added significantly, looking around the cavern at their unusual hosts, the better.
Binnebik eyed him, then turned back to Simon.
So, we shall be at putting things in order tonight.
Jiriki had appeared as though from thin air to join them at the fireside.
Ah, he said, I wish to speak to you about just these matters.
Surely there is no problem had with our leaving,
Binnebik asked, his cheerful expression not entirely masking a certain anxiousness. Hasten and Grimrick looked worried, Sludic ever so slightly resentful.
I think not, the Scyther replied. But there are certain things I wish to send with you.
He reached a long-fingered hand into his robe with a fluid gesture, producing Simon's white arrow.
This is yours, Siomen, he said.
What? But it belongs to you, Prince Jiriki. The Scyther lifted his head for a moment, as though listening to some distant call, then lowered his gaze once more.
No, Siomen, it is not mine until I earn it back. A life for a life.
He held it up between his two hands like a length of string, so that the slanting light from above burnished the minute and complicated designs along its length.
I know you cannot read these writings, Jiriki said slowly. But I will tell you that they are words of making. Scribed on the arrow by Vindao Meo, the Fletcher himself. Deep, deep in the past, before we of the First People were torn apart into the three tribes. It is as much a part of my family as if it were made with my own bone and sinew. And as much a part of me. I did not give it lightly. Few mortals have ever held a Staja Ame, and I certainly could not take it back until I had paid the debt it signifies.
So saying, he handed it to Simon, whose fingers trembled as they touched the arrow's smooth barrel.
I didn't understand, he stammered,
feeling as if he were the one suddenly under obligation. He shrugged, unable to say more.
So, Jiriki said, turning to Binnebik and the others, my destiny, as you mortals might have it, seems strangely bound with this man-child. You will not then find it too surprising when I tell you what else I would send along with you on your unusual and probably fruitless errand.
After a moment, Binnebik asked,
and what is that being, Prince?
Jiriki smiled, a feline, self-satisfied smile.
Myself, he answered, I will go with you.
The young pikeman stood long seconds, unsure of whether to interrupt the prince's thoughts. Joshua was staring out into the middle distance, knuckles white as he clutched the parapet of Naglaman's western wall. At last the prince seemed to notice the foreign presence. He turned, revealing a face so unnaturally pale that the soldier took a half step back.
Your Highness? He asked, finding it hard to look into Joshua's eyes.
The prince's stare, the soldier thought, was like that of the wounded fox he'd once seen the hounds take, and tear before it was dead.
Send me Deornoth, the prince said, and forced himself to smile,
which the young soldier thought the most horrible thing of all.
And send me the old man Yarnauger, the Rimmer's man. Do you know him?
I think so, your Highness.
With the one-eyed father in Bookroom.
Good man.
Joshua's face tilted toward the sky, watching the mass of inky clouds as though they were a book of prophecy. The pikeman hesitated, unsure of whether he was dismissed, then turned to sidle off.
"You man," the prince said, stopping him in mid-step.
"Your Highness?"
"What is your name?" He might have been asking the sky.
"Austrail, Highness. Austrail first from Sun. Lord. Out Runchester."
The prince looked over briefly. Then his gaze flicked back to the darkening horizon, as though irresistibly drawn.
"When were you last home in Runchester, my good man?" "Elysium answer, fall last, Prince Joshua. But I send them half my gettings, lord."
The prince pulled his high collar closer and nodded his head as though at great wisdom.
"Very well, then. Austrail first from Sun.
Go and send Deonoth and Yarnauga. Go now."
Long before this day, the young pikeman had been told that the prince was half mad. As he clomped down the gatehouse stairs in his heavy boots, he thought of Joshua's face, remembering with a shiver the bright, ecstatic eyes of painted martyrs in his family's Book of the Aden. And not only the singing martyrs, but also the weary sadness of Osiris himself, led in chains to the execution tree.
"And the scouts are certain, Highness?"
Deonoth asked carefully. He did not want to give offense, but he sensed a wildness in the prince today that he did not understand.
"God's tree, Deonoth, of course they are certain. You know them both, dependable men. The High King is at the Greenwade Ford, less than 10 leagues away. He'll be before the walls by tomorrow morning, with considerable strength."
"So Leobardus is too slow?" Deonoth squinted his eyes, looking not south where Elias' armies crept inexorably nearer, but west, where somewhere beyond the late morning mist the legions of the Kingfisher were laboring across the Inniscrick and the southern Frostmarch.
"Barring a miracle," the prince said. "Go to, Deonoth. Tell Sir Aedhgrim to hold all in readiness. I want every spear sharp, every bow tight strung, and not a drop of wine in the gatehouse or in the gatekeepers. Understood?"
"Of course, Highness,"
Deonoth nodded. He felt a quickening of his breath, a slightly sickening thrill of anticipation in his stomach. By the merciful God, they would give the High King a taste of Naglum and honor. He knew they would. Someone cleared his throat warningly. It was Yarnauga, scaling the stairs up to the broad walkway as effortlessly as a man half his age. He wore one of Strangyard's loose black robes and had tucked the end of his long beard under the belt.
"I answer your summons, Prince Joshua," he said, stiffly courteous.
"Thank you, Yarnauga,"
Joshua replied.
"Go on, Deonoth, I will talk with you at supper."
"Yes, Highness."
Deonoth bowed, helmet in hand, then was gone down the stairway 2 steps at a time. Joshua waited some moments after he was gone to speak.
"Look there, old man. Look!"
he said at last, sweeping his arm out over the clutter of Naglamund town and the meadows and farmland beyond, the greens and yellows dark painted by the glowering sky.
"The rats are coming to gnaw at our walls. We will not see this untroubled view for a long time, if ever."
"Elias' approach is the talk of the castle, Joshua."
"As it should be."
The prince, as if he had drunk his fill of the sights before him, turned his back to the parapet and fixed the bright-eyed old man with his own intense stare.
"Did you see Iskrimnor off?"
"Yes. He was not pleased to be leaving in secret and before dawn."
"Well, what else could be done? After we put about the story of his mission to Perdruin, it would have been difficult if anyone had seen him go in priest's robes, and as beardless as when he was a boy in Elrit's Hala."
The prince forced a grim, clenched-jawed smile.
"God knows, Yarnauga. Though I made sport of his disguising himself, it is a knife in my guts to have pulled that good man from his family and sent him out to try and recover my own failing."
"You are master here, Joshua. Sometimes being master means less of some kinds of freedom than that given to the meanest serf.
The prince tucked his right arm into his cloak. Did he take Kavania?
Yanaga grinned.
Sheathed beneath his outer robe. May your god save the one who tries to rob that fat old monk.
The prince's tired smile widened for a moment. Even God himself won't be able to help them in the mood Iskrimnor's in. The smile did not outlast the moment.
Now, Yanaga, walk with me here on the battlements. I need your good eyes and wise words.
I can indeed look farther than most, Joshua. So my father taught me, and my mother. That is why I am named Iron Eyes in our Remus back. I was taught to see through veils of deception as black iron cuts spells. But as to the other, I can promise no wisdom worthy of the name at this late hour.
The prince made a dismissive gesture. You have helped us already, I suspect, to see much we would not have. Tell me of this League of the Scroll. Did they send you to Tungoldia to spy on Stormspike? The old man fell in at Joshua's side, his sleeves fluttering like black pennants.
No, prince, that is not the League's way. My father, too, was a scroll-bearer.
He lifted a golden chain out of the neck of his vestments, showing Joshua a carved quill and scroll that hung upon it.
He raised me to take up his place, and I would have done no less to please him. The League does not compel. It asks only that one does what one can do.
Joshua walked silently, thinking. If only a land could be so ruled, he said at last. If only men would do what they should. He turned his thoughtful, grey-eyed stare to the old Rimmersman. But things are not always so easy, the wrong and right not always so apparent. Surely this League of yours must have its high priest or its prince? Was that Morghenis?
Yonaga quirked his lips.
There are indeed times when it would benefit us to have a leader, a strong hand. Our woeful unpreparedness for these events shows that.
Yonaga shook his head. And we would have granted such leadership to Dr. Morghenis in an instant if he had asked. He was a man of incredible wisdom, Joshua. I hope that you appreciated him when you knew him. But he would not have it. He wanted only to search and to read and to ask questions. Still, thank whatever powers that we had him as long as we did. His foresight is at this moment our only shield.
Joshua stopped, leaning with his elbows on the parapet. So this League of yours has never had a leader?
Not since King Aelstan Fiskerner, your Saint Aelstan, brought it together.
He paused, remembering.
There almost was one, and within my time. He was a young Hernestierman, another of Morghenis' discoveries. He had nearly Morghenis' skill, although less caution, so that he studied things Morghenis would not. He had ambitions, and argued that we should make ourselves more of a force for good. He might have one day been the leader you speak of, Joshua, a man of great wisdom and strength.
When the old man did not continue, Joshua looked over to see Yanaga's eyes fixed on the western horizon. What happened? The prince asked. Is he dead?
No,
Yanaga answered slowly, eyes still drawn out across the rolling plain.
No, I do not think so. He changed. Something frightened him, or hurt him, or something. He left us long ago.
So you do have failures? Joshua said, starting to walk again. The old man did not follow.
Oh, certainly,
he said, lifting his hand as if to shade his brow, staring out into the dim distance.
Priorities was one of ours once too.
Before the prince could reply to this, he was interrupted. Joshua! Someone cried from the courtyard. The lines around the prince's mouth tightened.
Lady Borsheva,
he said, turning to look down to where she stood indignantly, in a dress of gleaming red, hair aswirl in the wind like black smoke. Towser skulked uncomfortably at her side.
What would you of me? The prince demanded. You should be in the keep. As a matter of fact, I order you to the keep.
I have been there, she called crossly. Lifting the hem of her dress, she ankled toward the doorway, talking as she went. And I will soon go back. Do you not worry? But first, I must one time more see the sun. Or would you rather keep me in a black cell?
Despite his exasperation, Joshua was hard-pressed to keep his face entirely stern.
Heaven knows that there are windows in the keep, lady.
He lowered his frown to Towser.
Can you not at least keep her off the walls, Towser? Soon we are at siege.
The little man shrugged and limped up the stairs after Borsheva.
Show me the armies of your terrible brother, she said, a little breathless as she reached the prince's side.
If his armies were here, you would not be, Joshua said irritably. There is nothing to see, yet. Now please, go down.
Joshua.
Yanaga was still squinting into the cloudy west.
I think there is perhaps something to see.
What?
In an instant, the prince was beside the old Rimmer's man. His body pitched awkwardly against the parapet as he strained to find what the man saw.
Is it Elias? So soon? I see nothing.
He slapped his palm on the stone in frustration.
I doubt it is the High King, coming from so westerly a direction, Yanaga said. Do not be surprised you do not see them. As I told you, I was trained to look where others could not. Nevertheless, they are there. Many horses and men. Too far away still to guess how many. Coming toward us. There, he pointed.
Praise Osiris, Joshua said, excited. You must be right. It can only be Leobardis.
He straightened up, suddenly full of life, even as his face clouded with worry.
This is delicate, he said half to himself. The Nabene must not come too close, else they will be useless to us, caught between Elias and the walls of Naglamund. Then we shall have to bring them in, where they will be just more mouths to feed.
He strode for the stairs.
If they stay too far, we will not be able to protect them when Elias turns on them. We must send riders.
He went down the stairs at a bound, shouting for Deornoth and Aedgram, the Lord Constable of Naglamund.
Oh, Towser, Borsheva said,
her cheeks flushed with the wind and the pace of events.
We shall be saved after all. Everything will be better.
Just as well with me, my lady,
the jester responded.
I've been through this all before with my master John, you know, and I'm not anxious to do it again.
Soldiers were cursing and shouting now in the castle courtyard below. Joshua stood on the rim of the well, his slender sword in his hand, calling instructions. The sound of metal on metal as spear butts clanged on shields, and helmets and swords were hurriedly taken from the corners where they had been laid, rose past the walls like an invocation. Countess Spiters Preves exchanged a few terse words with Benegaris, then pulled his horse up beside the Duke's, matching him stride for stride through the high, dewy grass. The dawn sun was a shining smudge above the grey horizon.
Young Spiters, Leobardis said heartily, what news?
If he and his son were to be on better terms, he must try to show kindness to Benegaris' intimates. Even to Spiters, whom he considered one of the Praven House's less impressive products.
The scouts have just rejoined us, my Lord Duke.
The Count, a handsome, slender youth, was quite pale.
We are less than 5 leagues from the walls of Naglamund, my Lord.
Good. With luck, we shall be there in early afternoon.
But Elias is ahead of us.
Aspitus looked over to the Duke's son, who shook his head and cursed beneath his breath.
He has already laid the siege in strength?
Lebardus asked, surprised.
How? Has he learned to make his armies fly?
Well, no, Lord. It is not Elias.
Aspitus hurried to amend himself.
It is a large force riding beneath the flag of the Boar and Spears. Earl Guthwulf to attend Neith's banner. They have a half a league or so on us, and will keep us from the gates.
The Duke shook his head, relieved.
How many does Guthwulf have?
Perhaps 100 horse, my lord, but the High King cannot be too far behind.
Well, little should we care,
Leobardus said, reining up at the edge of one of the many small streams that crisscross the meadowlands east of Greenwade.
Let the High King's hand and his troop languish there. We are more used to Josua at a short distance, where we can harry the besiegers and keep the lines of supply open.
With a splash, he rode down into the ford. Benegaris and the Count spurred after him.
But, father,
Benegaris said, catching up,
think now. Our scouts say Guthwulf has moved ahead of the king's army, and with only 100 knights.
Despite his brevis, nodded confirmation, and Benegaris drew his dark brows together in a frown of earnestness.
We have thrice that, and if we send fast riders ahead, we can muster Joshua's forces too. We could smash Guthwulf against Naglamon's walls as between hammer and anvil.
He grinned and clapped his father's armored shoulder.
Think how that would sit with King Elias. Make him think twice, wouldn't it?
Leobardus rode silently for a long minute. He looked back at the rippling banners of his legions stretching back several furlongs across the meadows. The sun had for a moment found a thinner spot in the overcast, bringing color to the wind-bowed grass. It reminded him of the lakelands east of his palace.
Call the trumpeter,
he said, and Aspitus turned and shouted an order.
Here, I'll send riders ahead to Naglamon, father,
Benegaris said, smiling almost with relief. The Duke could see how much his son longed for glory, but it would be Naban's glory, too.
Pick your fastest riders, my son,
he called as Benegaris rode back through the lines,
for we shall move more swiftly than anyone dreams we can.
He raised his voice to a great shout, turning heads all through the field.
The legion shall ride for Naban and Mother Church. Let our enemies beware.
Benegaris returned shortly to pronounce the messengers dispatched. Duke Leobardus let the trumpets ring out, then sound again, and the great army set out at speed. Their hoofbeats sounded, rolling like rapid drumbeats in the meadow dells as they passed out of the Inniscrick. The sun rose in the muddy morning sky, and the banners streamed blue and gold. The kingfisher flew to Naglamond. Joshua was still pulling on his unadorned, bright-polished helm as he went through the gate at the head of 20 mounted knights. The harper Sangfugal ran alongside, holding something up to him. The prince reined in and slowed his horse to a walk.
What man?
He asked impatiently, scanning the misty horizon. The harper struggled for breath.
It is your father's banner, Prince Joshua, he said, passing it up. Brought out of the hayholt. You carry no standard but Naglamon's grey swan. What better one for yourself could you wish?
The prince stared at the red and white pennant, half unfolded in his lap. The firedrake's eye glared sternly, as if some interloper threatened the sacred tree about which it had enwrapped itself. Deornoth and Isorn, with a few of the other knights nearby, smiled expectantly.
No, said Joshua, handing it back. His look was cold. I am not my father, and I am no king.
He turned, wrapping the reins around his right arm and lifted his hand.
Forward,
he shouted.
We go to meet friends and allies.
He and his troop rode down through the sloping streets of the town. A few flowers, thrown by well-wishers from atop the castle walls, fluttered into the churned, muddy roadway behind them.
What do you see there, Remus man?
Towser demanded, frowning.
Why are you mumbling so?
Joshua's small force was now only a colorful blur, fast disappearing in the distance.
There is a troop of mounted men coming along the rim of the hills, to the south, Yanaga said. It looks from here not a large army, but they are still distant.
He closed his eyes for a moment as if trying to remember something, then reopened them, staring into the distance. Towser reflexively made the sign of the tree. The old Rimmer's man's eyes were so bright and shone so fiercely, like lamps of sapphire.
A boar's head on crossed spears, Yanaga hissed. Whose is it?
Garthwolf, Towser said, confused. The Rimmer's man might have been watching phantoms, for all the horizon revealed to the old jester.
Earl of Utanyate, the king's hand.
Farther down the wall, the Lady Vorsheva stared wistfully after the prince's vanishing horseman.
He comes from the south, then, ahead of Elias' full army. It looks as though Leobardis has seen him. The Nabene have turned toward the southern hills, as though to engage him.
How many? How many men? Towser asked, feeling ever more muddled. How can you see such a thing now?
I see nothing. My sight's the one thing that hasn't...
100 knights, perhaps fewer,
Yanaga interrupted.
That's what is troubling. Why are they so few?
Merciful God, what is the Duke up to?
Joshua swore, rising in his stirrups to gain better vantage.
He has turned east and is galloping full tilt toward the southern hills. Has he lost his wits? My lord, look!
Deornoth shouted across to him.
Look there, on the skirts of Bullback Hill.
By the love of the Aedan, it's the king's army. What is Leobardis doing? Does he think to attack Elias unsupported?
Joshua slapped his horse's neck and spurred forward.
It looks a small force only, Prince Joshua, called Deornoth. An advance party, perhaps.
Why didn't he send riders?
The prince asked plaintively.
Look, they will try and push them toward Naglamund, to trap them against the wall. Why in God's name did Leobardis not send riders to me?
He sighed and turned to Isorn, who had pushed his father's bear helm back from his brow, to better scan the horizon.
Now we will have our mettle tested after all, friend.
The inevitability of fighting seemed to have drawn serenity over Joshua like a mantle. His eyes were calm, and he wore an odd half-smile. Isorn grinned over at Deornoth, who was loosening his shield from his saddle pommel, then looked back to the prince.
Let them test it, lord, said the duke's son.
Ride on, the prince shouted. The despoiler of Utanyate is before us. Ride!
So crying, he spurred his piebald charger into a gallop, making the sod spurt beneath the horse's hooves.
For Naglamund,
Deornoth shouted, lifting his sword high.
For Naglamund and our prince!
Garthwolf is standing fast, Yanaga said. He holds on the hillside, even as the Nabene come against him. Joshua has turned to meet them.
They are fighting? Vorsheva asked, frightened. What is happening to the prince?
He has not reached the battle. There!
Yanaga was striding down the wall toward the southwestern turret.
Garthwolf's knights take the first charge of the Nabene. It is all confusion.
He squinted and knuckled his eyes.
What? What?
Towser put a finger in his mouth, staring and gnawing.
Do not go silent on me, Rimmer's man.
It is hard to make out what happens from this far,
said Yanaga, unnecessarily, for neither of his two companions, nor anyone else on the castle walls, could see anything but a faint smear of movement in the shadow of misty Bullback Hill.
The prince bears down on the fighting, and Leobardis and Garthwolf's knights are scattered along the hill slopes. Now,
he trailed off, concentrating.
Ah!
Said Towser in disgust, slapping his skinny thigh.
By Saint Nurfath and the Archangel, this is worse than anything I can think of. I might as well read this in a book. Damn you, man! Speak!
Deornoth found it all unfolding before him as in a dream. The murky shimmer of armor, the shouting and the muffled crash of blade on shield. As the prince's troop bore down on the combatants, he saw the faces of the Nabene knights come slowly up, and the Erkinlanders too, an eddy of surprise rippling out through the battle at their approach. For a timeless instant he felt himself a fleck of shining foam, prisoned at the crest of a hanging wave. A moment later, with a shocking roar and clash of arms, the battle was all around them, as Joshua's knights came full against the flank of Guthwulf's boar and spears. Abruptly, there was someone before him, a blank, helmeted face above the rolling eyes and red mouth of a war charger. Deornoth felt a blow to his shoulder that rocked him in his saddle. The knight's lance struck his shield and slid away. He saw the man's dark surcoat before him for an instant, and swung his sword with both hands, feeling a shivering impact as it caromed past the shield and struck the knight's chest, toppling him from his steed down into the mud and blooded grass. For a moment he was clear. He looked around, trying to find Joshua's banner, and felt a distant throb in his shoulder. The prince and Isorn, Iskrimnor's son, were fighting back to back in the midst of a swirling surge of Guthwulf's knights. Joshua's swift hand darted out, and Nadel pierced the visor of one of the black-crested horsemen. The man's hands flew to his metal-clad face, covered in an instant with red. Then he was yanked down out of sight as his reinless horse reared. Deornoth saw Leobardis, the Duke of Naban, sitting his horse at the farthest southeastern edge of the battle beneath his billowing kingfisher flag. Two knights held their bulking horses close by, and Deornoth guessed the large one in the chasework armor to be his son, Benegaris. Damn the man! Duke Leobardis was old, but what was Benegaris doing on the fringe of things? This was war! A shape loomed before him, and Deornoth spurred left to dodge a downrushing battle axe. The rider blew past, unturning, but was followed by another. For a while, all was swept from his head but the dance of stroke on stroke as he traded blows with the Utanyita. The clangor of the field seemed to subside to a dull rush, like the sound of falling water. At last he found an opening in the man's guard and crashed a sword stroke against his helm, crumpling it in at the visor hinge. The knight toppled sideways and off, his foot caught in the stirrup so that he hung like a butchered hog in a pantry. His maddened horse dragged him away. Earl Guthwulf, black-mantled and black-helmeted, was now only a stone's throw away, dealing blows left and right with his great broadsword, holding off two blue-coated Nabene horsemen as if they were boys. Deornoth leaned down in his saddle to spur toward him. What glory to trade blows with the monster of Utanyit! When a toppling horse beside him spun his own mount around, pausing, still as muddled as if he dreamed, he found he had been driven down the hill toward the outer edge of the battle. The blue and gold banner of Leobardis was before him. The Duke, white hair streaming from beneath his helm, stood high in the stirrups, shouting exhortations at his men, then pulled his visor down over his bright eyes, preparing to spur forward into the fray. The dream turned to nightmare as Deornoth watched, the one whom he took for Benegaris, moving so slowly that Deornoth almost felt he could reach out a hand and stop him, pulled back his long blade and carefully, deliberately, pushed it into the back of the Duke's neck under the helm. In the milling crowd, with the battle crashing all around them, it seemed that no one but Deornoth saw this terrible act. Leobardis arched his back as the blade was withdrawn, scarlet-streaked, and brought trembling, gauntleted hands up to his throat, holding them there for a moment as if trying to speak through some all-swaying grief. A moment later, the Duke sagged forward in his saddle, leaning into his horse's white neck and smearing the mane with his unprisoned blood, before rolling off his saddle to the ground. Benegaris looked down for a moment, as if contemplating a bird tumbled from its nest, then tugged his horn to his lips. For a moment, with shouting chaos on every side, Deornoth thought he saw a gleam in the black slot of Benegaris' helmet. As if the Duke's son caught his eye across the heads of all the fighting men between them. The horn sounded long and harsh, and many heads turned. "Tambana, Leobardis, yes!" Benegaris bellowed, his voice a dreadful thing, ragged and sorrowful. "The Duke is down! My father is killed! Fall back!" He sounded the horn again, and even as Deornoth stared in unbelieving horror, there came another horn call from the hillside above them. A line of armored horsemen sprang out of the shadowed concealment of the trees.
Lights of the North, Yanauga groaned, sending Towser into another paroxysm of frustration.
Tell us, how goes the battle?
I fear it is lost, the Rimmersman said, his voice a hollow echo. Someone has fallen.
Oh,
Vosheva gasped, tears standing in her eyes.
Joshua, it is not Joshua.
I cannot tell. I think it may be Leobardis. But now, another force of men comes down the hillside, out of the trees. Red-coated, on the banner.
An eagle? Farshir,
Towser groaned, and pulling off his belled hat, flung it clattering onto the stone.
Mother of God, it is Earl Fangbald. Oh, Osiris Aiden, save our prince, the horse and bastards.
They ride down on Joshua like a hammer, Yanauga said, and the Nabene are confused, I think. They... Fall back,
Benigaris shouted, and despite his prowess at his side, plucked the banner from the stunned arms of Leobardis' squire, riding the young man down beneath his horse's hooves.
There are too many,
Aspitus cried.
Retreat! The Duke is dead!
Deornoth pulled his horse around and plunged back through the melee toward Joshua.
A trap!
He shouted. Fengbold's knights were thundering down the hillside, lances agleam.
It is a trap, Joshua!
He cut his way through two of Guthwulf's boars, who would have blocked his path, taking hard blows on his shield and helm, running the second man straight through the throat, and almost losing his sword as it stuck in the spine. He saw a rill of blood run past his visor, and did not know if it was some other's or his own. The prince was calling back his knights, Isorn's horn blaring above the screaming and clashing of arms.
Benigaris has killed the Duke,
Deornoth cried. Joshua looked up, startled, as the blood-stained figure bore down on him.
Benigaris has stabbed him in the back! We are trapped!
For a brief instant, the prince hesitated, lifting his hand as though to raise his visor and look around. Fangbald and his eagles had pitched toward the Naglimunda's flank, trying to cut them off from their retreat. A moment later, the prince raised his rain-wrapped shield arm.
Your horn is on, he shouted. We must cut our way back! Back! Back to Naglimund! We are betrayed!
With a blast of the horn and a great cry of anger, the prince's knights surged forward, directly into Fengbold's wide-strung crimson line. Deornoth goaded his horse forward, trying to reach the front, and watched as Joshua's whirling blade snaked through the guard of the first eagle, striking serpent-like beneath the man's arm, in and out. A moment later, Deornoth found a host of red surcoats before him. He swung his blade and cursed. Although he did not know it, beneath his helm his cheeks were wet with tears. Fengbold's men, startled by the ferocity of their attackers, wheeled slowly about. And in that instant the Naglimundas broke through. Behind them, the Nabene legions were in full retreat, flying brokenly back toward the Inniscrick. Guthwulf did not pursue them, but rather sent his troops to join Fengbold in pursuit of Joshua's fleeing knights. Deornoth hugged his charger's neck. He could hear its breath rasping as they galloped full out, back across the meadows and fallow farmland. The sound of pursuit gradually fell away as the walls of Naglimund rose ahead. The gate was raised, a black open mouth. Staring at it, his head throbbing like a beaten drum, Deornoth suddenly wanted very much to be swallowed, to go sliding down into deep, lightless oblivion and never come out again. Chapter 40. The Green Tent.
No, Prince Joshua, we cannot allow you to do such a foolish thing.
Isorn sat down heavily, favoring his leg.
Cannot?
The prince lifted his gaze from the floor to the Rimmer's man.
Are you my keepers? Am I a child regent or an idiot that I should be told what to do?
My prince,
Deornoth said, resting a hand on Isorn's knee to urge him to silence.
You are master here, of course. Do we not follow you? Have we not all sworn our allegiance?
Heads around the room nodded somberly.
But you ask much of us. You must know that. After such treachery as has been done to us, do you really think you can trust the king at all?
I know him as none of you do,
Joshua, as if burned by some inner fire, leaped up from his chair and paced to his table. He wants me dead, certainly, but not this way. Not so dishonorably. If he swears safe conduct, and if we avoid obvious stupidity, then I will return unharmed. He still wants to act the High King, and the High King does not slay his brother unarmed beneath a flag of truce.
Then why did he throw you in the cell you told of? Asked Ethelfirth of Tynset, scowling. Are you thinking that's proof of honor?
No, Joshua replied, but I don't think that was Elias' idea. I see no other hand but Priorates there, at least until after the deed was done. Elias has become a monster. God help me, for he was my brother once in more than blood. But he still has a queer sense of honor, I think, Deonoth hissed air. Such as he showed to Leobardis?
The honor of a wolf who slays the weak and flees the strong? Isorn sneered.
I think not. Joshua's patient grimace was stretched tighter. Benigaris patricide has the feeling of a grudge to me. I suspect that Elias...
Prince Joshua, with your pardon,
Yanaga interrupted, raising eyebrows around the room.
Do you not think you are stretching to find excuses for your brother? These are useful concerns that your liegemen have. Just because Elias asks for parley does not mean you are bound to go to him. No one will question your honor if you do not.
Aiden, save me, man. I care not a whit for what anyone thinks of my honor, the prince snapped. I know my brother, and I know him in ways none of you can understand. And don't tell me he has changed, Yanaga. He glared, forestalling the old man's words. For no one knows that better than I do. But nevertheless, I will go, and I need not explain any more. I wish you all to leave me now. I have other matters to think on. Turning from the table, he waved them from the room.
Has he gone mad, Deonoth? Isorn asked, his wide face heavy with apprehension. How can he walk into the king's bloody hands this way?
Stubbornness, Isorn. Oh, what am I to say? Perhaps he does know what he speaks of.
Deonoth shook his head.
Is that damn thing still there?
The tent? Yes, just out of bowshot from the walls. Also well out of range of Elias' encampment as well.
Deonoth walked slowly, allowing the young Rimmersman to set the pace his wounded leg demanded.
God save us, Isorn. I have never seen him like this, and I have served him since I was old enough to draw sword.
It is as if he seeks to prove Gwythyn wrong, who called him reluctant.
Deonoth sighed. Well-a-day, if there is no stopping him, we must then do our best to protect him. The king's herald said 2 guards, no more?
And for the king the same.
Deonoth nodded, thinking. If this arm of mine... he indicated the white linen sling, is movable by the day past tomorrow, then no force on earth will keep me from being one of those guards.
And I shall be the other, Isorn said.
I think better you should be inside the walls with a score or so mounted men. Let us speak to the Lord Constable Aedgrim. If there is an ambush, if even a sparrow is seen to fly from the king's camp toward that tent, you can be there in a few heartbeats.
Isorn nodded.
I suppose. Perhaps we can talk to the wise man Yanaga. Ask him to give Joshua some charm to protect him. What he needs, and it hurts me to say it, is a spell to protect him against his own rashness.
Deonoth stepped over a large puddle.
Anyway, no charm is proof against a dagger in the back.
Luth's lips were in constant silent movement, as though offering an endless series of explanations. His mumbling had slipped over into soundlessness the day before. Maegwin cursed herself for not having taken note of his last words, but she had been sure he would find voice again, as he had many times before since his wounding. This time she could sense he would not. The king's eyes were closed, but his wax-pale face worked ceaselessly through changing expressions of fear and sorrow. Touching his burning forehead, feeling the muscles flexing weakly in the unfulfilled rhythms of speech. She again felt as though she must cry, as though the tears welling inside her, unshed, would eventually force their way out through her very skin. But she had not wept since the night her father had led the army out into the Inniscrick. Not even when they had brought him back in a litter, maddened by pain, the yards of cloth bandaging his stomach soggy with dark blood. If she had not cried then, she never would again. Tears were for children and idiots. A hand touched her shoulder. Meguin, princess. It was Eolair, his clever face folded in grief as neatly as a summer robe stored for the winter. I must speak to you outside.
Go away, Count, she said, looking back to the rough bed of logs and straw. My father is dying.
I share your grief, lady. His touch was heavier, like an animal nosing blindly in the dark. Believe me, I do. But the living must live, the gods know, and your people have need of you this moment. As if he felt his words too cold, too proud, he gave her arm a brief squeeze and let go.
Please, Luth Oblithen would not want it any other way.
Maegwin bit back a bitter rejoinder. He was right, of course. She stood, her knees aching from the stone cavern floor, and followed him past her silent stepmother, Inarwen, who sat at the foot of the bed staring at the guttering torches on the wall.
Look at us, Maegwin thought wonderingly. It took the Hernisteria a thousand years to crawl out of the caves into the sunlight.
She ducked her head to pass beneath the low spot of the cavern ceiling, squinting her eyes against the gritty torch smoke.
And yet, it has taken less than a month to drive us back in again. We are becoming animals. The gods have turned their backs on us.
She lifted her head up again as she emerged into daylight behind Eolair. The clutter of the daytime camp was all around her. Carefully watched children playing on the muddy ground, court women, many in the tatters of their best clothing, on their knees preparing squirrel and hare for the stew pot, and grinding grain on flat stones. The trees growing close all around on the rock-studded slope of the mountain bent grudgingly to the wind. The men were nearly all gone. Those not dead on the Inniscrick, or having their wounds tended in the honeycomb of caves, were out hunting, or guarding the lower slopes against any move by Skali's army to finally crush Hernisteer's battered resistance.
All we have left are memories, she thought,
looking down at her own stained and ragged skirt.
And the hiding holes of the Kreanspok. We are treed like a fox. When Elias the Master comes to take the prey from his hound Skali, we are finished.
What is it you want, Count Eolair? She asked.
It is not what I am wanting, Maegwin, he said, shaking his head. It's Skali. Some of the sentries came back to say he's been down at the bottom of the Moya Brach all morning, shouting for your father.
Let the pig shout, Maegwin scowled. Why doesn't one of the men put an arrow into his dirty hide?
He's not near in bowshot, princess, and he has 50 men with him. No, I think we should go down and listen to him. From cover, of course, out of sight.
Of course, she said scornfully. Why should we care what Sharp Nose has to say? Come to demand surrender again, I don't doubt.
Possibly. Count Eolair lowered his eyes, thinking, and Maegwin felt a rush of sorrow for him, that he should have to bear up under her ill will. But I think there is something else here, lady. He has been there an hour or more, the men say.
Very well, she said, wanting to get away from Loth's dark bed, and hating herself for the wish. Let me put on my shoes and I will come with you.
It took the better part of an hour to climb down the forested mountainside. The ground was wet and the air was chilly. Maegwin's breath rushed out in little clouds as she picked her way down the gullies after Eolair. The grey cold had driven the birds out of the Kirkcoil, or numbed them into silence. No sound accompanied their passing but the shivering murmur of wind-raked branches. Watching the Count of Nad Mullach making his nimble way through the undergrowth, so like a child with his slender back and shiny tail of hair, with his movements so quick and unthinking, Maegwin was again filled with a dull, hopeless love for him. It seemed such a ridiculous way for her to feel, tall, gawky child of a dying man, that it turned into a kind of anger. When Ayla turned back to help her over a jutting stone, she frowned, as if he had offered her insult instead of his hand. The men huddled in the copse of trees overlooking the long ridge called Moyabrach, looked up in startlement at the approach of Eolair and Maegwin, but quickly lowered their bows again and beckoned the pair forward. Peering through the bracken down the finger of stone for which the ridge was named, she saw a milling crowd of ant-like shapes at the bottom, some 3 furlongs away.
"He just stopped speaking a moment ago," one of the sentries whispered, a young boy, eyes wide with nervousness. "He'll start again, princess, you'll see."
As if in planned confirmation, one of the figures strode out from the throng of men in helmets and capes who surrounded a wagon and team of horses. The figure raised his hands to his mouth and stood facing slightly to the north of the watcher's hiding place.
"The last time," his voice drifted up, muffled by distance, "I offer you hostages. Return for..."
Maegwin strained to make out the words.
"Information?
About the wizard's boy and... princess!"
Ayla snapped a glance over to Maegwin, who sat stock still. What did they want with her?
"If you do not tell where princess is, will these hostages..."
The man who spoke, and Maegwin was sure in her heart it was Skali himself, just from the wide-legged stance and the sour, mocking tone that even distance could not wholly obscure, waved an arm, and a struggling figure in a rag of light blue was taken from the wagon and brought to where he stood.